The theme text from our Daniel, the third chapter, as brought out 16 to 18, which we hope to look at in detail. So we'll start in Daniel 3. You can turn there. We want to consider what we would consider to be a symbolic picture or a prophetic picture outlined in this chapter. But I want to especially emphasize, hopefully, in this time, lessons for what I think we might face in the future and what we can learn from their example. And I think there's a prophetic knowledge which is important, but there's an element of courage that the final feet members of the little flock will have in order to withstand the intensity and the ferocity of what we think they will face at the hands of those who are in powerful positions, even as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego withstood the onslaught that they face in not only just intimidation, but just outright threat of violence, as we know, as we're familiar with the story. You might jot down reprint 2494. Reprint 2494 is from the year 1899, so it's a latter reprint in my mind, the last 16 years of Brother Russell's earthly ministry there. I think you'll find that there's a 3 to 4 page reprint on this very topic of Daniel, the third chapter, and on Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, where he does apply the lessons there for our spiritual benefit, for what he foresaw as a future persecution on the feet members, and what we can learn from it, even in our daily lives now, when we are met with opposition in our witness to the truth, which all of us have experiences of, and which each one of us are now, actually, we are being schooled by our little experiences now. And when I say little, they're usually not life-threatening, but when we're passing through some of these oppositions, it doesn't seem very little at the time. It can be very intimidating. It can cause a lot of angst and anxiety to us if we allow it. And so the very lessons of the bigger nature of a final opportunity, while that's there, and we think that is the point, yet on a more daily basis, we can learn and gain insights on how they conducted themselves, and then also we will look, Lord willing, at how Jesus, the apostles, and others conducted themselves when they too were confronted with powerful opponents. And it's always good to remember in all of it that, as Paul wrote, and we do not wrestle with flesh and blood, but with wicked spirits in exalted places. So we want to always bear in mind, and I think this is an important tool of knowledge that you and I can have, that when we're in conflicts with humans, that we know they're blinded. Satan has blinded the minds, just like they blinded the minds of the Jewish leaders, Peter said, when they put Jesus to death. There is a responsibility, but the Lord will take care of that. Their culpability, he'll handle that. But on our part, it's up to us to remember that we're really wrestling against the wicked spirits who hate the light that we have and are trying to share with others, even as they hated the Master. So we keep that in mind as helpful, that the very ones opposing us, we look forward to hopefully assisting them up the highway of holiness in the future if we're faithful. And what a tremendous blessing it'll be if we're able to then assist the very ones who are such our opponents in this life, if in this life we gave them a good witness by not only our words but by our conduct, by the spirit in which we oppose the errors. Right? Won't that be much more powerful? Because we want to, as Paul says, adorn the doctrine by how we conduct ourselves now for this time. But also, brethren, keep in mind, if we're faithful, our goal is to help them more completely in the future. So what we do now will have an effect on how effective we'll be there. Because if we were a lousy witness now in our confrontation with them, how do you like to meet them there and then we have to say, oh, well, I'm sorry I acted that way, but it really was true. How much better to say, remember when we had that conflict and you were so enraged, and even though it's true I was kind of excited, yet you know that I didn't curse you or condemn you, but that I was trying to share truth with you? See, we'll be much happier. And the witness then will be much more powerful than just us. So, keeping the spiritual understanding of the deeper lesson of the greater battle that's being played out in the spirit realm, of which we, by faith, understand, but yet here in the flesh, this is where it's taking place now. In the future, we'll look back on each one of these incidences, I think, with the individuals we had confrontations or conflicts with, and how we can help them then will depend much on how helpful we are now. And we're going to get back to this, but only because there's times where in silence you'll have your strength, in quietness we'll have our strength as a testimony. And at times Jesus saw that in the audience or in the situation, his silence was actually a superior witness than if he spoke. So that's something to keep in mind too. It's almost like if you don't have something good to say, don't say anything at all. Sometimes that is a powerful witness. If there's not a setting, or if we aren't thinking clearly, or whatever it may be, sometimes silence is that which is in itself most powerful. Okay, I'll leave that there. So we're in Daniel, the third chapter, and the setting we suggest is that Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, about 20 years approximately after he had had the dream interpreted for him by Daniel, which he was a head of gold over this Gentile metallic image, he decides to create an image. And I'm going to suggest it probably was of himself after a fashion. And he made it all of gold because Daniel told him in the dream, thou art the head of gold. So he thought, well, if the head's gold, well, then I'm going to make the rest of it gold because it represents me. And that is also being 20 years later. Nebuchadnezzar had historically a series of victories. He had defeated the Egyptians along with some other neighboring countries. So he felt here in this third chapter with the setting up of this image that he was full of himself. He was full of himself. And he thought his gods had given him these victories. And he'd lost sight of Daniel's God, who had interpreted the dream for him about 20 years earlier. He wasn't really paying attention to things the way he should have on this. And yet, at the conclusion of our lesson, as we know, by the witness of Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, and the miraculous way in which the Lord God Almighty gave deliverance, this brought Nebuchadnezzar back to his senses, back to the one true God of the Hebrews, Jehovah, and he recognized that again. He's a conflicted man in his history, isn't he? But the Lord dealt peculiarly with him. But in this setting here, we find him having an image created, all of gold, and he was setting it up for a means of probably trying to consolidate his control and unify his kingdom of mixed people. And it is a group of mixed people who were there. For example, in verse 4, then a herald cried aloud to you, it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages. So I'll just here again to emphasize, of the conquered people, there was a mixed multitude there. And so he was undoubtedly trying to consolidate them under his authority by his civil authority as the king, but also by bowing down and worshiping the gods whom he worshiped and acknowledging him as being those gods' earthly representative, because he is the one who got all these victories. So all you subjugated people, your gods must be inferior because you were defeated. With the Jewish people, the Lord God had used Nebuchadnezzar to punish his wayward people and to destroy the temple, the city, of Jerusalem and to give them a 70 years desolation removed from their land at the hand of Babylon, and later Babylon would be punished after being the tool of chastisement upon Israel. That's the only reason Nebuchadnezzar had any victory in a sense with that. But the other nations, their gods are inferior. They are no gods. So that's neither here nor there. As usual, we're focused on the God of the Hebrews, Jehovah. Okay. The religious and civil combination is usually the strongest. Historically, it's been that way, and we believe that once again, it'll be attempted for an hour of power in the future, where religion and civil power will cooperate to the extent to try to control the peoples. When you have whatever spiritual, whether it's superstition, spiritual superstition, if you will, and you couple that with the security of a civil force, so you've got the security of a religion, security of a civil force working together, if they're on the same page, those people feel, in a sense, we've got the best of both worlds. And that's what Nebuchadnezzar here was trying to accomplish, we would suggest. Okay. Let's do a little reading, starting in verse 1. Chapter 3 of Daniel, verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold whose height was 80 cubits and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. So just stopping here for a second. The plain of Dura is actually in the heart of the city of Babylon. The city of Babylon was quite huge, and in the center of it was this plain. And the plain itself, I understand, is about 24 square miles in today's standards. So with this 90-foot-tall image, now it might not be the whole image of 90 feet. It might be on a base, possibly. There's different speculations. But think of the Statue of Liberty. It, too, is on a base, which gives it amplified height. Nonetheless, this is somewhere around 90 feet, like an 8 to 9-story building. So it'd be readily seen by all the inhabitants of the city because it's set up in the center. So it becomes the centerpiece of acknowledgement for Nebuchadnezzar as a king. You know what I think of, even though it's not an image, I just think of the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C. It's just like straight up pillar, super tall. It's in the center. It can be seen from all angles. And some would say it's a Masonic symbol, and probably very well be, but nonetheless, the long and short of it, we can see examples of how people like to have these impressive material structures to look at to overawe them in this sense. But this one was an image of probably the king himself, and being all gold, just think of how that would radiate and look when the sun hits it. So super impressive. Well, verse 2, Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, sent to gather together the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. And then it tells us in verse 3 that all those that we just mentioned, they all came. And at the end of verse 3 it says, and they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then an herald cried aloud, to you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And whosoever falleth not down and worship shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. So, just stopping here, let's break this down a little bit, but I'm going to just set a certain thought. As in that reprint, we mentioned 94, Brother Russell suggests that Babylon represents Christendom. And we think of it as two senses. There's a civil sense of antitypical Babylon, and yet there is a religious sense of which the papacy is the mother of harlots, and then the Protestants, the daughter harlots, they are all considered part of Babylon. a religious element and the civil element. And so in our understanding here of what we're suggesting to you, we're following that train of thinking. And I'll also plainly state that we think that this verse 6, where it says the same hour that this is set up and the musical acclamations go forth, the herald cries out, they're all to worship. I'm going to suggest to you that that's the hour of Revelation 17 where the 10 kings, which had received no power as yet, shall receive power for 1 hour and shall give their power unto the beast, and these shall make war against the Lamb and those that are with him, called, chosen, and faithful. I think that's the same hour. I think it's future. I think it's a short period of time. It's when a church and state are cooperating and they're going to make war with the Lamb, and the only way you can do it, like when Paul made war against Jesus, he made it against Jesus' body members, the church and the flesh. And I think that's the repeat of what happens here, but it's going to be for this short hour, this period future. I wanted to give you these verses in Revelation 17. I know you know them, but it's Revelation 17, verses 12, 13, and 14. 17, 12 through 14. And the point in particular in 14 is that these shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called chosen and faithful. For this would show that the 144,000 would be complete, but the war is made on those sealed saints that are still in the flesh, the final feet members. But this is the same period of time, the same hour that's mentioned here is the same hour we think mentioned back in Daniel 3 verse 6. The image that he sets up, we think, is an excellent example of the image of church and state being united, but in particular, we think of Revelation 13, where you have an image of the beast that is vitalized by the two-horned beast. Now, the image of the beast with the evangelical alliance that was formed in 1846, the two-horned beast that would give it life, as it were, is the Church of England. And the thought of giving life under that image is, as Brother Russell suggests, it is the supposed apostolic succession that their bishops have, that they pass on from the days of the apostle down to their leadership, so that they have this apostolic type of authority in their clergy. And the Protestants don't claim much of that, but we think that is what is going to transpire. They're working hard at it behind the scenes even now between the papacy, the Church of England, and the Protestants. They all recognize, the nominal churches recognize, that this is just a bummer, that before the world, they're all divided. They know that that's a problem amongst them, and they're working hard at the ecumenical movement for unity, and this pope is working as hard as any pope has to try to bring this about. That being said, think of this image that was literally made back here. Image of gold. How do you make an image of gold that's that tall? Well, you take sand or clay and you form the mold laying down flat. It's in the earth. And then you pour in your gold, and however it was exactly made, you do have to have a mold to create this. It was probably hollowed. I don't think it was solid gold that tall, but it was probably hollowed with a filler on the in-between. But the point is, it was there, flat, as it were. It's made in the earth, showing it's earthly, even though it claims to be gold, it claims to be of divine origin, yet it has yet to be stood up, and that's the difference. It's there now, the image is there, it's waiting vivifying. When it's vivified, it will be stood up, and then in that hour, the short period of time, there will go the command forth that you have to worship this. If you don't worship it, you're killed. Well, in Revelation 13, the closing verses, this is exactly what the vitalized image says about it. It is, you have to receive the mark of the beast in your forehead or in your hand, and if not, you will be killed. You've got to receive it in your head or your forehead. Rich and poor, small and great, all will be forced to receive this mark. Either in the forehead, where you mentally assent to their false doctrines and practices, or at least in the hand, where at least you'll cooperate with it, even if you don't agree, out of fear of being killed, the persecution. So the long and short of this, brethren, this is all, we believe, tying together. I think Brother Russell understood it that way. In the fourth volume, in the 1912 forward, It's about 16 pages. He goes through this whole outline, and I know you're familiar with that. You've studied it. In the 1916 forward to the fourth volume, interestingly, the only volume that has two forwards, it's about four pages in a few sentences, the 1916 forward. Brother Russell just reestablishes what he wrote in the 1912 forward by when he says, the Bible seems to indicate, or the Bible teaches, without giving the verses, he's saying, in essence, in my mind, I've already covered that in the 1912 forward and in the body of this volume. In this 1916 forward, he says, I'm not rehashing all that. I'm just reminding you that I believe there's going to be this future church-state cooperative effort after the end of this war, which will try the feet members of the church. I'm just reiterating you, I'm getting that from Bible verses, and I've already outlined that in the 1912 forward. It's not me prognosticating it, because in this 1916 forward, I'm owning up that my expectation of the church being complete in 1914 didn't happen that way. But other things did, like the end of the Gentile times, the process of removing the Gentile governments. This current war will end, and the real problem of the Armageddon conflict is going to happen after that war. And Babylon will be a queen for an hour. All that's in the 1916 forward, written basically 30 days before he graduated. By the way, did you know that Rutherford tried to stop the printing of the 1916-1970 volumes with that foreword in it? He went to the book published printer, because you remember Brother Russell had the volumes printed in the winter to take advantage of the cheaper prices. He wrote the 1916 forewords, which means they would come out in the 1917 edition of the volumes. He okayed it. P.S.L. Johnson writes in his book on Morariism that Judge Rutherford, that it was Johnson himself that got the final approval from Brother Russell about October 14th or 15th to deliver it to the book printer, the 1916 forwards, and Brother Russell left on his final train trip. When Rutherford got into his position of power, he went to the book printer and he says, we don't want that printed. And the book publisher says, well, it's been paid for, so you got a choice. I'm keeping the money because we had a contract. You want the books or not? So he said, okay, we'll take the books. So the Lord overruled. I think it was about January 6th. It was in the month of January of 1917, Judge Rutherford became president. So I just think, brethren, of the time frame. We're talking just months in here. If we didn't have those 1916 forwards, we might be in the same kind of situation as some of our brethren over in Eastern Europe who didn't have the 1916 forward. They thought the door was shut. And when the brethren went over after communism fell and brought them this information, then with the 1916 forwards, no, Brother Russell taught this, he corrected this. Some of them had a hard time believing it. But many of our brethren then accepted that the high calling was open. So this is marvelous things that have taken place and we're benefiting from. All right. I know that was a digression, but I think it's of interest for us to keep this kind of knowledge, because we see Satan is just trying to hinder the church from being complete in all these variety of ways, and yet the Lord keeps overruling. But we need to be paying attention. So here, we've covered that hour. I'm going to offer a suggestion on then, a symbolic suggestion on this verse 3, who the princes and onward are. See if it appeals to you or not. This assembled crowd, as it were. Nebuchadnezzar would be the head of civil authority. The princes would represent international leaders of industry and finance. The governors might represent national civilian leaders. The captains might represent military leaders. The judges would represent legislators. The treasurers would represent national financial leaders. The counselors might be national political leaders. The sheriffs might represent law enforcement leaders. And the rulers of the provinces would be municipal leaders. Now, the point is, of making mention of this, is just showing that this would be the social, financial, political, military, law enforcement arrayment, that the leaders are all there and they're in agreement. They're bowing down to this image and they're the solid flanks on this side of supporting the status quo and this religious belief. They're bowing down to these gods. But you notice I didn't mention a religious leader in there. The religious leaders don't seem to pop up until verse 8. Wherefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. And the Jews here would be our Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These are our religious leaders, the Chaldeans. The religious leaders are, of course, in harmony with this. These are the ones who approach the kings, pointing out those who, on religious belief, wouldn't go along with this church-state relationship. And that has been the accusers throughout history. It was the religious leaders that accused Jesus before Pilate, before Herod. It was the Jewish leaders that accused Paul before Felix and Festus. It was the religious leaders who condemned Daniel before Darius. So you see, Satan continually works to thwart the children of light or the Lord's representatives, whether they were ancient worthies or whether they're the spirit begotten in these different ages. Satan's always at work through the religious element primarily, but they have to go to the civil powers in order to try to accomplish their will. And so here we're seeing the exact same scenario plays right into it. Moving down here a little bit, this music, a lot of fanfare, all these different instruments. And so it shows that it's like a celebration, if you will, and it's meant to overawe the people. And I'll just suggest to you along this line that so often the scriptures portray that the Lord's people get persecuted during a event. It's like the Lord is indicating that the stage is going to be set where this persecutive power take place. Example with Jesus, it was not only the Passover, but he was also finally condemned to death the day that Pilate would have been customarily to release a prisoner. And instead, as we know, it was Barabbas who was released instead of Jesus. So it was an event. John the Baptist was beheaded on Herod's birthday. There was this fanfare there in a sense of music with Salome dancing. So it was an event. Babylon fell in Daniel the fifth chapter, Belshazzar's feast. It was an event. Here we have this event. Daniel, when he was persecuted, it's easy to overlook it, but there was an event there. There was a 30-day window of not to worship others, and Daniel prayed. A 30-day period. Again, like an event. So, when we look to this, and sometimes we can say to ourselves, we look around at the current political, financial, world situation, and we say, I don't see how we could ever get back to a church state. So, I can understand that kind of thinking just when we're meeting here so calmly and we have these liberties. But brethren, things turn on a dime. Historically, we've seen this. Things turn on a dime. When we just think of the rise of Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party from the mid-1930s to, they were done by, 45? 1945, right? Turned on a dime and they almost had all of Europe. However, in the scheme of things, they were undone. But what atrocities they committed in that short period of time. So historically, things can turn on a dime. It looked hopeless for the early church. Let's just take another one. It looked hopeless. When Jesus died, there was about 500 who believed. Yet, on the day of Pentecost, how many were converted with Peter's preaching? 3,000, was it? Just like that. One day. Because of the supernatural events with the empowerment of the Holy Spirit and then Peter's preaching. But it was a psychological moment, and Peter capitalized on that under the Lord's guidance. It just put together Jesus, the Messiah, supernatural events had taken place there, the darkening of the sun, the opening of the tombs, the earthquake. Even the centurion said, Son of God. So, the long and short of it is, brethren, while we might not see it now, let's not think that it's impossible. When we see how rapidly things can take place. And who wants to get that hour of power set up? Satan. Well, he can certainly accomplish a lot through fallen man. How about God? God has foreknown and has put in his word that he wants it. He's allowing it. because it will be to his glory in the end. Who put Jesus to death? The Romans? The Jewish leaders? Satan. Satan was the one that entered Judas Iscariot to work through the Jewish leaders, who Peter later said they were blinded, to work on the Romans to get him actually crucified. God allowed it. God foreknew it. It was in his plan. Jesus even said, they're going to do this to me. So, brethren, if we see it in his word that the final feet members were expecting to suffer persecution, no matter how unlikely it might seem to us, there's enough indicators that it could come about very quickly. On 9/11, tomorrow, 15-year anniversary, right after 9/11, we saw so much religious fervor in this country, God and country, because people were scared. And so what do? They turn to God. They turn to the country. Not out of deep reverential faith. They're just putting up the sandbags. Okay. This music is like a counterfeit of the song of Moses and the Lamb. The ones who have the harps of God in Revelation 15 are those who didn't receive the mark or worship his image. These are the ones who have the true doctrinal message, the true understanding of the plan of God of ransom and restitution, that these kingdoms must fall to establish the true kingdom of God on their ruins. That's the true song, and only they can sing it. Only they can present these truths. But here, Satan always is trying to counterfeit that, and so the counterfeit truth here with all this music and fanfare is a counterfeit of the song of Moses. The counterfeit is that this is God's blessing on the civil leaders, the financial leaders, the military leaders, and your legislators that we have put together, as it were, a cooperative union between the civil element and your spiritual leadership, so that you can be assured that what we have here during this hour of power is what's for your best good, for your security, for your children's welfare, so you can continue to draw your Social Security check, so you continue to get your Medicare payments, so you continue to get what pension you might have, so you might be able to get money from the bank, so that you could have those medical benefits, so that we have law and order in our streets. So much so that, now let me turn this around a little bit. Was Jesus put to death for religious reasons? Well, yes, on one hand, but how is it presented? That he was actually a political offender. That he made himself a king. And anyone who makes himself a king is no friend of Caesar. That's finally what turned Pilate. He didn't care about the religious sentiment of the Jewish leaders, that he made himself to be the Son of God. Actually, that put the fear in Pilate. He said, whoa. But when they said, we have no king but Caesar, the religious leaders were saying, we have no king but Caesar, that suddenly made Jesus a political offender. Now, in the second volume, Brother Russell writes that we would not be surprised that in the future we might be persecuted as political offenders for not going along with any church-state system that might be presented before us. And what is church-state? It's harlotry, right? And we have to abstain from every form of spiritual harlotry. We're not involved with the government. Just like Jesus gave that witness before Pilate. And he said, if my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would fight. But it's not. And that's our position. And what a great position. Because look at your choices today. Our political prospects. It's a blessing, not that feel, that we're responsible to participate in that. And we look forward to the day when all people will realize that we cast our vote for our King, Jesus, long ago. Well, with this, we move down through what happened. And in verse 12, these Chaldeans, the religious leaders there in Babylon, were saying to Nebuchadnezzar, there are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, a Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Do not ye serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? Now if you be ready that at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the image which I have made, well, or is it, it's well for you. But if you worship not, you shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? So just stopping there, Nebuchadnezzar is infuriated. This looks like treason to him. And treason from three who he had placed in an exalted position. And yet he thought, well, I'm going to give them another chance. I'll let them speak for themselves. You know, here's the Chaldeans have accused them. They came to me, but I'm going to put it before them. Brethren, I think this is a interesting setting. The narrative could have read that Nebuchadnezzar would just cast him into the prison based on what the Chaldeans said. Cast him into the fiery furnace just based on what the Chaldeans had said. But rather, the Lord overruled it in such a way that would be this confrontation after the setting. Well, we had that with so often, for example, with Jesus. He had no less than six trials, three before religious leaders and three before civil leaders on his last night. So he had the opportunity. Sometimes he spake and sometimes he didn't. Sometimes he spake in one way before certain ones, like the religious leaders. He brought out in the end that he was indeed the Son of God out of their own mouth. And then there was the three civil trials, one before Herod, where he didn't say anything. And I think that was just plainly because Herod wasn't even a rightful ruler. He wasn't even fully Jewish by any stretch. And that he had also already been given a witness and hadn't hearkened to it. And so he wasn't going to be there for entertainment value before this Herod. He was of no consequence. But before Pilate, who he felt was less responsible, he gave witness of several ways. And he did spend some time in explaining, as we have previously mentioned, that Christ's kingdom was not of this world. But he did say something else to Pilate, which we think why he conversed longer with him. He said, those who delivered me unto you, that is the religious leaders, they have greater light, so they're more responsible in the eyes of God. And indeed, that's true. The religious leaders do have more responsibility in the eyes of God. And the Christian leaders today have more responsibility. And I'm going to suggest to you the most responsible are those who are right in the United States of America because they have had the harvest message here in their own language for over 100 years. They've had the freedoms. They've had the public education. They have the Bibles and all the different Bible translation helps. And they still have them. So the religious leaders here in this country are the most responsible because they've had the greater privileges and light, and yet they haven't hearkened unto it. And in fact, in the future, we think they'll persecute it, even as they downplay it and reject it. Now, quick side note, you've had the same experience, but let me just amplify it because of what we just had. We were just worked at the Michigan State Fair for 5 days, and I talked to a gentleman who said he was a minister. He had a 3,700 member church. And I was trying to get to a point with him of trying to demonstrate why what we have here that he could take away, even free, would be of interest to him. And one of it was it promotes God as a God of love because it demonstrates that every human who's ever lived will benefit from the ransom that Jesus provided. So he's kind of listening. He's kind of nodding his head in agreement to a certain extent with a look of a little bit of credulity. And then I brought out that this is contrary to the thought of a fiery burning hell where God is going to torment people forever and ever. Well, I lost them right there. That was that. So that's okay. He left. And I kind of brought it to a head with him. Yet when others come up that aren't of the clergy class, and you talk to them, that's where we find our greatest reception, don't we? It's not the leadership of Christendom. It's actually the people who are honest-hearted and are seeking. And they don't have the same dog in the fight, for example. The clergy, if they know, if they accept truth, something different, there goes the pension, there goes their retirement, there goes their health benefits, there goes their paycheck, there goes their prestige. And yet, I want to amplify this. There's a fine brother in Jackson, Michigan, Brother Tom Murray, who was an Orthodox priest, and when he heard the truth, he walked away from it all. Now, we have a living example today of that kind of faithfulness. But how rare, right? I've got one to point out, but it's rare because they have more to lose. So, in saying all that, and it was the religious leaders that had condemned Jesus. It was the religious leaders that were condemning Paul. It was the religious leaders that were condemning Peter. So they bear this greater responsibility. But the civil power, with this picture by Nebuchadnezzar here, he was giving Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego an opportunity to either redeem themselves, cooperate, or explain themselves. Even as Jesus had these various trials. Even as Peter stood before the Jewish leadership in the temple when they condemned Peter and John for practicing miracles and teaching Jesus. Yet, in all these situations, we're going to suggest that the manner in which the faithful ones from Jesus on down handled themselves are to be our examples of how we would like and hope to conduct ourselves if we're so privileged to be in a similar position. We're going to get more into that here shortly. But be it said, we think the Lord set this stage with Nebuchadnezzar to show that the civil powers and authorities are actually a little more sympathetic to the Lord's representatives, not out of religious belief, but rather they just see good people. They don't have the same vehemence that the religious leaders have. Suggesting that Satan uses that religious fervor and that error of it in order to amplify this persecution of the Lord's people. So too, even in Revelation 17 and in Revelation 18, it's really the religious element, the beast element, that is prompting the king's elements in order to persecute the Lord's faithful people. And they later regret it, like Pilate was reluctant and regretted it, like Herod was reluctant at the urging of Salome and Herodias to behead John. So we have these pictures, and they help us just understand the dynamics of what's really taking place, and knowledge is a friend to us to assist our courage at the time when we see how these things unfold. When the elements fall into line, it helps us when we think, well, the scripture said this about that. The scriptures seem to intimate this. The scriptures hinted at that. And then when it starts to unfold that way, even if we're alone, we're able to look back on our studies and reflections and we're saying, this is how it was meant to be. I didn't quite have this right, but this is the basic understanding. And this is not coming at me out of the blue, even though it's happened very suddenly, yet the scriptures had forewarned us about this. So with that being said, I think that's what we have here with our standing. I'm going to suggest that there will be this opportunity to give a final witness by the feet members in front of the civil leaders. And we say to ourselves, well, how could that be? We're of no consequence. Well, brethren, we've all recognized now with the advent of the internet and the web and such that seemingly nobody suddenly become almost like household names. Because it was the setting and the moment. Of themselves, they seem to be nothing. But circumstances propels them into the spotlight. It happens very rapidly. And under the Lord's direction, we could see how quickly things could develop to where, on one hand, the adversary might think, well, let's give them a trial. We'll show how ridiculous their claims are. And we'll show them to be traitors to God and country. Yet under the Lord's direction, the very same thing that what Satan has designed is actually works to the Lord's pre-planned arrangements. And if we're so privileged to be tools at that time, if we are sanctified aright, the Lord might be blessed to use it. We might be blessed to be used of the Lord. The answer here in verse 16, getting to our points, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. What does that mean? That means not that they aren't careful giving a respectful reply to the king, which we believe they did, very respectful. But rather, they didn't have to think over the matter. They knew exactly what their position and response was going to be. And so they say, if it be so, Our God whom we serve is able to deliver us, and he will deliver us out of thy hand, O king. But if not, in other words, if God doesn't design us to be delivered out of thy hand, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Clear? To the point? It wasn't a rant. It wasn't a cursing. It wasn't a belittlement. But it was clearly stated. And sometimes, as the expression goes, less is more. Sometimes the whole demeanor of a presentation makes all the difference, adorning the doctrine. But the simple sincerity of the expression, that's what impresses people. And this might be a worldwide internet audience in the sense that Satan would design to have this as a public display of what happens to traitors. And yet it can backfire just this way. That's a very probable scenario. The way in which we die, the firmness of our faith can carry with it the conviction. You know, anyone can look up what we believe very easily, right? You can find what Bible students believe. It's not hard anymore with the internet. Very easily. But nonetheless, that being said, the long and short of it is, we're only responsible for what the Lord sets before us. We can't change other things. We're responsible for being prepared beforehand, which is why we think we have all this in the harvest message, in the scriptures. But we're also, we need to apply ourselves. As we said earlier on, we can practice these principles in our regular opportunities that we have of witnessing for truth and righteousness. Practice not being hotheads in a discussion. Practice having a moderate temperament, even though we express ourselves clearly and plainly and with conviction. One of the best witnesses I've ever seen at the fair booth, using that as an example again, was a sister. She's gone to her reward now. Sister Linda Pedler. She was very confirmed in her faith. And yet she wouldn't be like an eloquent speaker. But nonetheless, her simplicity and sincerity in handing out the tract and drawing attention to people to stop as they went by the booth. And then her expression of her conviction on the truth. Very simply, we saw her place more literature with that than, you know, any kind of like eloquent presentation that some might have. But people appreciate that. People do appreciate. So I say that so that any little brothers or sisters in the sense of feeling their own infirmities and inabilities or lacks, remember, even one talent, and that one talent might be that you made yourself available for the Lord to use. That might be all it is. That talent might just be you made yourself available. The Lord can use it more powerfully than others because it's all to His glory. It's all to His glory. So too with this final witness. Interestingly, in this narrative, which you're so familiar with, and I'm going to kind of move through it, they didn't bow down. And Nebuchadnezzar ordered mighty men, verse 20, mighty men to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, bind them up, to heat that furnace sevenfold, and to toss them in. And they heated that furnace to its maximum. It seven might represent a perfect trial of their faith in the fire, fiery trials. And yet they died just being that close to throw them in, which demonstrates that there is no human strength that could withstand this fiery trial the way these three Hebrews did, unless it's demonstrating it's the new creature that survived the trial, not our flesh. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego represented the new creature in this fiery trial. Their flesh and our flesh likewise, like Jesus' flesh, can be destroyed. But the new creature is what's exalted. In this picture, with those mighty men being slain, not even in the furnace, but throwing them, is demonstrating flesh could not have withstood what they withstood. Now, it's true, they were in the flesh, and literally the Lord did save them. However, we think the picture is, it's demonstrating that only a new creature can be survive in this situation, under this persecution, and this type of trial. So they're cast in, it says they fall down. Again, it shows a humiliation. They fall down, they're bound, and they're thrown in. So they fall down, but lo and behold, when Nebuchadnezzar looks in, he says, didn't we throw in three? He goes, yeah, we threw in three. And well, I see four. It's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They're loosed. They're standing. And there's a fourth one in their midst that looks like the Son of God. Very powerful. He says, looks like the Son of God. Why would he say, looks like the Son of God? Well, there was some demeanor about him that we would almost think maybe angelic looking, but the real key is for us to understand as new creatures. Remember, Paul said all these things happen unto them for lessons to us. So we look for the spiritual lesson. I think this is demonstrating that Jesus, our returned Lord, will be with these final feet members in their final fiery affliction that actually will succor and give us strength. And I don't mean that we're going to have a literal seeing. I don't think we're going to hear a literal words from him. But I will suggest that there will be an acute awareness of the Lord's presence with us, his strength, probably similar to how Jesus felt strengthened after his third prayer to the Heavenly Father in the Garden of Gethsemane, and then he was calm through everything else he endured. He received a sense of assurance. And I'm going to suggest, I think this is what it's offering unto us, this sense here that in the persecution we won't be left alone. We won't have to rely on our own ability, but rather the Lord will be in our midst to give us this strength and encouragement. I think the picture changes here at this point. I'm going to suggest that what is happening is that it for us, the spiritual lesson, would show that as Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego represented the final feet members of the church in their final persecution, they're changed in a twinkling of an eye, and they're glorified. So that when, and they're loosed from their bonds of human flesh. I'm suggesting that. So when Nebuchadnezzar then brings them out and has them exalted, I think that just depicts that after the church is glorified, after the final Armageddon crash, that what will happen is that worldly leaders will recognize that the church had been faithful unto the Lord and are now highly exalted. It's just a transition, kind of like how Elisha changes in his picture after Elijah's death. For a period of time, he's represented a great company. Then he transitions into the ancient worthies represented. And I'm just saying this is kind of a similar transition. But if it's not that way, if that doesn't appeal to you, okay. This is just a suggestion. The end result is that God, Jehovah God, gets the glory for deliverance. That's the main key. But remember that we had a similar kind of deliverance in two pictures that we put together. John the Baptist represented the final feet members of the church, Brother Russell suggests, and he was a semi-type of Elijah, the church in the flesh. John the Baptist was beheaded, and it looked like he died. Well, he did die, but it looked like he was vanquished completely. But yet Elijah, when the fiery trial separated Elijah from Elisha, the little flock from great company separated, it was a whirlwind that took Elijah into heaven. So Elijah seemed to have a glorious transformation. John the Baptist shows, from the world's perspective, it looks like the church is vanquished, like Jesus when he was crucified on the cross and died there. From the world's perspective, it just looked like he was dead and gone. But as Jesus was raised on the third day and was understood that happened. He was resurrected in power and great glory on the third day. That was only seen and believed by his followers. It's still by faith. So too, Elijah, when he was caught up, showed heaven's view of the deliverance of the final feet members of the church. So too, here, I think this is what this picture is showing in both ways with the three children. from the world perspective, it looks like they were delivered, and indeed they were, but it's actually, from our perspective, it's the new creature that ends up being glorified and loose from these bonds of the flesh. Okay, we'll leave that there. I want to read to you a manna text. This is August 11th. Manna for August 11th. The text is from Revelation 2:10, in part, be thou faithful unto death, and I'll give thee a crown of life. But here's the comment. We are to anticipate a second attack upon the true church, not upon the nominal system. And this may mean, as in the case of John the Baptist, a second and seemingly complete victory of the Babylonish woman and her paramour, the world, over the faithful members of the body of Christ in the flesh. We shall certainly not be surprised if the matter so result. But this and all things must work together for good to those who love the Lord. We must all die to win our heavenly prize beyond the veil. The Elijah class this side of the veil must and will be vanquished, but the apparent defeat only hastens the kingdom glories. I still read this, still believe it, because I think Brother Russell was looking at the scriptures, particularly in Revelation, and these types that we've just talked about, as he mentioned Elijah and John the Baptist, I think he believed it. The thought is that this is all around the world. Brother Russell is expecting this even for himself when he says we. So that was his thinking. In 1 Peter 2:21, for even thereunto were you called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should know, should follow his footsteps. So clearly, Peter's saying, our Lord left us this example on how he conducted himself, and we want to walk in his footsteps. But now he condenses what aspect he's talking about, particularly in verse 22. Who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth, who, when he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but committed his cause, marginal reading, to him that judgeth righteously. So, brethren, this is the attitude we want to cultivate. This doesn't come magically. This is something that we develop by reflecting over and over and over and meditating how Jesus conducted himself under his trials. Our flesh likes to revile when we're reviled against. We've become self-defensive, and we can lash out. We don't like being misrepresented. We don't like being falsely accused. We don't like people putting words in our mouth. We don't like people saying what they think we meant. And that's all that happened to Jesus. And yet, how did he respond? So as we reflect on these things, and we think about how he conducted himself, the greatest mastery of ourself is to follow our master's footsteps. One of the best ways is to remember that he's not expecting us to vindicate ourselves before fallen man. He's not expecting us to be able to explain to others where they would accept what motivates us in the way of truth and righteousness. That we don't have that job. Blessedly, we don't have that job. We can't do it. Satan will be sure of that. He'll work through someone to be sure of that. But if we have a clear conscience before the Lord on how we conduct ourselves and how we express these beautiful truths, then in that manner we'll have the Lord's approval. So we've got that example in Jesus. When we're threatened, that too creates fear. It's intended to create fear, which is expected to make us either break down emotionally or mentally with this onslaught. However, with Jesus, it solidified. The threat of violence solidified in his mind what he was supposed to do, because he knew from the prophecies that he was going to be killed for such a thing. It confirmed the threats, confirmed what he had previously studied and understood. Brethren, with us, if we are so studied in these matters, hopefully, and we get practice now along the way, hopefully when we're accused to that degree with the violence, instead of the fear of what man might do to us, let it turn to reverence that we'd rather do the will of God in faithfulness because we know it's the will of God that we'd suffer for righteousness because the scriptures taught us that and we believe it. But we can use this as a, like a role reversal. The very thing meant to intimidate us confirms why we should act. And if we're feeling undone, then let it be silence at the moment. Just don't give in. Just don't agree. Just resist the mark. I know our time is gone. Let me say, in closing, I'd like to give you, a verse here to think about. And I know you know it, but let me just put it out here. Matthew 10, verses 16 through 20. Matthew 10, verses 16 to 20. You'll remember that's where Jesus said they're going to haul you before the synagogues, before religious leaders, before kings, and think not what you say, the Spirit will give it to you. Here's the reprint that elaborates on that beautifully. The reprint is 5330. Long and short of it is, the article is about courage. But for us, brethren, it's not a formula of words that we're to memorize. It's the principles of truth and righteousness. That's what we're to keep in mind. And that the old order passes away only to bring in a more beautiful, glorious order. May the Lord have his blessing.